Men still clutched their pitchforks, ladies still huddled with their children. Elizabeth felt her eyes moisten as she imagined the horror of their final moments, the screams, the sight of others being torn to pieces before their eyes, the horror of being eaten alive by creatures of unspeakable evil. A tear fell down Elizabeth's cheek. She was quick to wipe it away, feeling somewhat ashamed that it had escaped at all.
"A house of God so defiled," said Maria as their journey continued. "Have these unmentionables no sense of decency?"
"They know nothing of the sort," said Elizabeth, staring mindlessly out of the coach's window. "And neither must we." With no further alarm, they reached Mr. Gardiner's house, where they were to remain for a few days. Jane looked well, and Elizabeth had little opportunity of studying her spirits amidst the various engagements which the kindness of her aunt had reserved for them. But Jane was to go home with her, and at Longbourn there would be leisure enough for observation. It was not without an effort, meanwhile, that she could wait even for Longbourn before she told her sister of Mr. Darcy's proposals. To know that she had the power of revealing what would so exceedingly astonish Jane was such a temptation to openness as nothing could have conquered, but the state of indecision in which she remained as to the extent of what she should communicate, and her fear, if she once entered on the subject, of being hurried into repeating something of Bingley which might only grieve her sister further.
She was grateful, therefore, when a distraction presented itself in the form of a disturbance on the east wall. Jane, Lizzie, and Maria had been at midday cards when, through a window in the parlour, they had observed men with muskets and buckets running in the direction of Mr. Gardiner's factories, a few at first, and then in droves. "A fire?" asked Jane.
"Or worse," cried Lizzie. "Best we hasten to our katanas, lest the latter be true."
No sooner had she finished these words than Lizzie's breath was taken by an extraordinary sight. A living man, his hair and clothing in flames, ran wildly through the street, crying out at the top of his voice, "The wall has fallen! The wall has fallen! They approach! They approach!" Upon this, the sisters hurried to their swords and shooting irons, and made off with no scarcity of swiftness, leaving Maria to her panic. Unmentionables had been amassing on the east wall for days. This was due to no particular strategy on their part. Rather, a large herd had likely been wandering west and simply run into the wall by chance. Not having sense enough to walk to their left or right, they simply continued ahead. As more wayward dead joined their ranks, the pressure on the massive brick wall began to build. The army had attempted to disperse them from above, bombarding them with large rocks, pouring hot tar on their heads, and emptying bags of lye onto them in a desperate attempt to hasten their decomposition. They had even sent for brains from the London morgue, pitching them in different directions in hopes of scattering the lot. Nothing had worked. The officers had been reluctant to use fire, lest the blaze grow beyond their control and consume the wall itself. Finally, after days of assault by hundreds of dreadfuls, a section of the wall had collapsed. In their panic, many soldiers had ignored their orders and set fire to several buildings near the site of the collapse, believing that the sight of flame would drive the devils back. This had indeed slowed the advancing hordes, but the conflagration now threatened all of Section 8 East, including Mr. Gardiner's powder mill. Jane and Elizabeth ran against the force of the fleeing masses. Upon reaching the wall, they were relieved to find that only a small sliver of it had collapsed, and that the invading dreadfuls had been contained to Crown and Winston streets. There were no more than 24 creatures on each of these, most of them gathered over living victims, feasting on their flesh and innards, even as the poor souls struggled to break free. The sisters parted ways, the elder to Crown Street, the younger to Winston. With their katanas moving more rapidly than the eye could make out, their musket balls blistering the air, and their throwing stars flying about in every direction, they made short work of the 50-odd zombies that had broken through. The others were held safely at bay by the fire, which had spread beyond all hope of suppression. "Jane! Uncle's factory!"
Elizabeth could see flames dancing up the walls of the two brick buildings on nearby Greenwall Street. Workmen scurried into the daylight like rats, each of them terribly aware that the factory contained enough black powder to destroy everything within a half mile.
There was nothing more for the sisters to do but run for their lives, and this they did with no want of haste, until an unearthly force lifted them off their feet and carried them through the air. The explosion was felt as far away as Section 10 Northwest. More than half of the windows in Parliament were shattered, and though never confirmed, it was rumoured that one of His Majesty's porcelain battle scepters shattered when it fell from its perch. Jane and Elizabeth had the good fortune to land in the Thames near Putney Bridge. Their modesty was more injured than their persons, for their wet gowns proved quite a scandalous sight on the long walk home. Though he survived with little more than a scratch, Mr. Gardner's factories were reduced to dust, and scores of his workmen lost their lives. It was a small price, however, for the happy result of the explosion. The force had not only remitted the remaining unmentionables to hell, it had filled the collapsed wall with fresh rubble, thereby rendering it impassable.
Chapter 39. It was the second week in May in which the three young ladies set out together from Section 6 East for Hertfordshire, and as they drew near the appointed inn where Mr. Bennet's carriage was to meet them, they quickly perceived, in token of the coachman's punctuality, both Kitty and Lydia looking out of a dining-room upstairs. These two girls had been above an hour in the place, happily employed in amusing the sentinel on guard with immodest displays of their proficiency with a throwing star, much to the consternation of the carriage-horse which served as their unwilling target. After welcoming their sisters, they triumphantly displayed a table set out with such cold meat as an inn-larder usually affords, exclaiming, "Is not this nice? Is not this an agreeable surprise?" "And we mean to treat you all," added Lydia, "but you must lend us the money, for we have just spent hours at the shop out there." Then, showing her purchases, "Look here, I have bought this bonnet." And when her sisters abused it as ugly, she added with perfect unconcern, "Oh, but there were two or three much uglier in the shop, and when I have bought some prettier coloured satin to trim it with fresh, I think it will be very tolerable. Besides, it will not much signify what one wears this summer after the soldiers have left Meryton, and they are going in a fortnight." "Are they, indeed?" cried Elizabeth with the greatest satisfaction, for not only would her sisters have one less distraction from their training, but the very fact of the decampment meant that Hertfordshire had been much relieved of the unmentionable menace while she was away.
"They are going to be encamped near Brighton, and I do so want Papa to take us all there for the summer. It would be such a delicious scheme, and I dare say would hardly cost anything at all. Mamma would like to go too, of all things. Only think what a miserable summer else we shall have, with hardly any balls to be had in Meryton."
"Yes," thought Elizabeth, "a summer with so few balls would be miserable indeed for a girl who thinks of little else."
"Now I have got some news for you," said Lydia as they sat down at table. "What do you think? It is excellent news, capital news, and about a certain person we all like."
Jane and Elizabeth looked at each other, and the waiter was told he need not stay. Lydia laughed and said,
"Aye, that is just like your formality and discretion. You thought the waiter must not hear as if he cared. I dare say he often hears worse things said than I'm going to say. But he is an ugly fellow. I never saw such a long chin in my life. I nearly ran him through for thinking him a zombie. Well, but for my news, it is about dear Wickham. Too good for the waiter, is it not? There is no danger of Wickham's marrying Mary King. There's for you. She has gone down to her uncle at Liverpool, gone to stay. Wickham is safe."
"And Mary King is safe," added Elizabeth, "safe from a connection imprudent as to fortune."
"She is a great fool for going away if she liked him."
"But I hope there is no strong attachment on either side," said Jane.
"I am sure there is not on his. I will answer for it. He never cared three straws about her. Who could about such a nasty little freckled thing with not a skill to boast of?"
As soon as all had ate and the elder ones paid, the carriage was ordered, and after some contrivance, the whole party, with all their boxes, weapons and parcels, and the unwelcome addition of Kitty's and Lydia's purchases, were seated in it.
"How nicely we are all crammed in!" cried Lydia. "I am glad I bought my bonnet, if it is only for the fun of having another hat-box. Well, now let us be quite comfortable and snug and talk and laugh all the way home. And in the first place, let us hear what has happened to you all since you went away. Have you seen any pleasant men? Have you had any flirting? I was in great hopes that one of you would have got a husband before you came back. Jane will be quite an old maid soon, I declare. She is almost 23. Lord, how ashamed I should be of not being married before 23. My Aunt Phillips wants you so to get husbands, you can't think. She says Lizzie had better have taken Mr. Collins, but I do not think there would have been any fun in it. Lord, how I should like to be married before any of you, and then I would chaperone you about to all the balls, dear me. We had such a good piece of fun the other day at Colonel Foster's. Kitty and me were to spend the day there, and Mrs. Foster promised to have a little dance in the evening. By the by, Mrs. Foster and me are such friends, and so she asked the two Harringtons to come, but Harriet was ill, and so Pen was forced to come by herself.
Elizabeth presently drew her katana and cut off Lydia's head, which fell into the open hat-box. The others looked on in a state of silent shock as a torrent of blood sprang forth from Lydia's neck, staining their dresses. Elizabeth sheathed her blade, and in a most delicate tone said,
"I beg you all forgive me, but I could stand her prattling no longer."
However, when she spared another glance toward Lydia, she was surprised to see her head very much attached.
"Lord, how I laughed," continued her younger sister, "and so did Mrs. Foster. I thought I should have died."
Elizabeth sighed. If only she could really cut off Lydia's head. With such tireless drivel did Lydia, assisted by Kitty's hints at additions, endeavour to amuse her companions all the way to Longbourn. Elizabeth listened as little as she could, but there was no escaping the frequent mention of Wickham's name. Their reception at home was most kind. Mrs. Bennet rejoiced to see Jane in undiminished beauty, and more than once during dinner did Mr. Bennet say voluntarily to Elizabeth, "I am glad you are come back, Lizzie." Their party in the dining-room was large, for almost all the Lucases came to meet Maria and hear the news, and various were the subjects that occupied them. Lady Lucas inquired after the welfare of her eldest daughter, who Maria reported in excellent health and spirits.
"Has everyone gone mad?" thought Elizabeth. "Can no one see that she is 9/10 dead from the plague?"
Mrs. Bennet was doubly engaged. On one hand, collecting an account of the present fashions from Jane, who sat some way below her, and on the other, retailing them all to the younger Lucases. And Lydia, in a voice rather louder than any other person's, was enumerating the various pleasures of the morning to anybody who would hear her.
"Oh, Mary," said she, "I wish you had gone with us, for we had such fun. As we went along, Kitty and I opened the carriage windows and played at taunting the farmhands who were charged with burning the morning's body piles. And when we got to the George, I do think we behaved very handsomely, for we treated the other three with the nicest cold luncheon in the world, and if you would have gone, we would have treated you too. And then when we came away, it was such fun. I thought we never should have got into the coach. I was ready to die of laughter. And then we were so merry all the way home. We talked and laughed so loud that zombies might have heard us 10 miles off."
To this Mary very gravely replied, "Far be it from me, my dear sister, to depreciate such pleasures. They would doubtless be congenial with the generality of female minds, but I confess they would have no charms for me. I should infinitely prefer a good spa." But of this answer Lydia heard not a word. She seldom listened to anybody for more than half a minute, and never attended to Mary at all. In the afternoon, Lydia was urgent with the rest of the girls to walk to Meryton and to see how everybody went on, but Elizabeth steadily opposed the scheme. It should not be said that the Miss Bennets could not be at home half a day before they were in pursuit of the officers. There was another reason, too, for her opposition. She dreaded seeing Mr. Wickham again, and was resolved to bloody his mouth when she did. The comfort to her of the regiment's approaching removal was indeed beyond expression. In a fortnight they were to go, and once gone she hoped there could be nothing more to plague her on his account. She had not been many hours at home before she found that the Brighton scheme, of which Lydia had given them a hint at the inn, was under frequent discussion between her parents. Elizabeth saw directly that her father had not the smallest intention of yielding, but his answers were at the same time so vague and equivocal that her mother had never yet despaired of succeeding at last. Chapter 40 Elizabeth's impatience to acquaint Jane with what had happened could no longer be overcome, and at length, resolving to suppress every particular in which her sister was concerned, she related to her the next morning the chief of the scene between Mr. Darcy and herself. Jane's astonishment was soon lessened by the strong sisterly partiality which made any admiration of Elizabeth appear perfectly natural. She was sorry that Mr. Darcy should have delivered his sentiments in a manner so little suited to recommend them, but still more was she grieved to learn that they had resulted in combat and the destruction of Mr. Collins's mantelpiece.
"His being so sure of succeeding was wrong," said she, "and certainly ought not to have appeared, but consider how much it must increase his disappointment."
"Indeed," replied Elizabeth, "I am heartily sorry for him. But he has other feelings, which will probably soon drive away his regard for me. You do not blame me, however, for refusing him?"
"Blame you? Oh, no."
"But you blame me for having spoken so warmly of Wickham?"
"No, I do not know that you were wrong in saying what you did."
"But you will know it when I tell you what happened the very next day." She then spoke of the letter, repeating the whole of its contents as far as they concerned George Wickham, particularly his treatment of the deaf stable-boy and Miss Darcy. What a stroke was this for poor Jane! She would willingly have gone through the world without believing that so much wickedness existed in the whole race of mankind as was here collected in one individual. Nor was Darcy's vindication, though grateful to her feelings, capable of consoling her for such discovery. Most earnestly did she labour to prove the probability of error, and seek to clear the one without involving the other.
"This will not do," said Elizabeth. "You never will be able to make both of them good for anything. Take your choice, but you must be satisfied with only one. There is but such a quantity of merit between them, just enough to make one good sort of man, and of late it has been shifting about pretty much. For my part, I am inclined to believe it all Darcy's, but you shall do as you choose." It was some time, however, before a smile could be extorted from Jane.
"I do not know when I have been more shocked by the living," said she. "Wickham so very bad, it is almost past belief, and poor Mr. Darcy. Dear Lizzie, only consider what he must have suffered. Such a disappointment, and with the knowledge of your ill opinion, too, and having to beat his sister's governess. It is really too distressing. I am sure you must feel it so."
"Certainly. But there is one point on which I want your advice. I want to be told whether I ought or ought not to make our acquaintances in general understand Wickham's character."
Miss Bennet replied,
"Surely there can be no occasion for exposing him so dreadfully. What is your opinion?"
"That it ought not to be attempted. Mr. Darcy has not authorized me to make his communication public. On the contrary, every particular relative to his sister was meant to be kept as much as possible to myself, and if I endeavour to undeceive people as to the rest of his conduct, who will believe me? The general prejudice against Mr. Darcy is so violent that it would be the death of half the good people in Meryton to attempt to place him in an amiable light. I am not equal to it. Wickham will soon be gone, and therefore it will not signify to anyone here what he really is. At present, I will say nothing about it."
"You are quite right. To have his errors made public might force him to demand satisfaction from Mr. Darcy, and when two gentlemen duel, there is seldom a happy result. We must not make him desperate. In the words of our dear master, a caged tiger bites twice as hard."
The tumult of Elizabeth's mind was allayed by this conversation. She had got rid of two of the secrets which had weighed on her for a fortnight, but there was still something lurking behind, of which prudence forbade the disclosure. She dared not relate the other half of Mr. Darcy's letter, nor explain to her sister how sincerely she had been valued by Bingley. She was now, on being settled at home, at leisure to observe the real state of her sister's spirits.
Jane was not happy. She still cherished a very tender affection for Bingley. Having never even fancied herself in love before, her regard had all the warmth of first attachment,
and from her age and disposition, greater steadiness than most first attachments often boast. And so fervently did she value his remembrance and prefer him to every other man, that all her good sense and all her attention to the feelings of her friends were requisite to check the indulgence of those regrets which must have been injurious to her own health and their tranquillity.
"Well, Lizzie," said Mrs. Bennet one day, "what is your opinion now of this sad business of Jane's? For my part, I am determined never to speak of it again to anybody. I told my sister Philip so the other day. But I cannot find out that Jane saw anything of him in London. Well, he is a very undeserving young man, and I do not suppose there's the least chance in the world of her ever getting him now. There is no talk of his coming to Netherfield again in the summer, and I have inquired of everybody, too, who is likely to know. I do not believe he will ever live at Netherfield any more."
"Oh, well, it is just as he chooses. Nobody wants him to come. My comfort is, I am sure Jane will die of a broken heart, and then he will be sorry for what he has done."
But as Elizabeth could not receive comfort from any such expectation, she made no answer.
"Well, Lizzie," continued her mother soon afterwards, "and so the Collinses live very comfortable, do they? Well, well, I only hope it will last. And what sort of table do they keep? Charlotte is an excellent manager, I dare say. If she is half as sharp as her mother, she is saving enough. There is nothing extravagant in their housekeeping, I dare say."
No, nothing at all. Elizabeth couldn't bring herself to tell her mother of Charlotte's doom. The poor woman was scarcely able to keep herself together as it was.
"I suppose they often talk of having Longbourn when your father is dead. They look upon it as quite their own, I dare say, whenever that happens."
It was a subject which they could not mention before me.
"No, it would have been strange if they had, but I make no doubt they often talk of it between themselves. Well, if they can be easy with an estate that is not lawfully their own, so much the better. I should be ashamed of putting an old woman out of her home."
Chapter 41 The first week of their return was soon gone. The second began. It was the last of the regiment's stay in Meryton, and all the young ladies in the neighbourhood were sick with melancholy. The dejection was almost universal. The elder Miss Bennets alone were still able to eat, drink, and sleep, and pursue their daily exercises, which at this time of year included games of Kiss Me Dear, a game their father had invented to better their softness of foot and arm strength. The rules were simple. Sneak up behind one of the large bucks grazing in the nearby woods, wrestle it to the ground, and kiss it on the nose before letting it go. Jane and Elizabeth laughed many an afternoon away in such a manner. Very frequently were they reproached for this insensibility by Kitty and Lydia, whose own misery was extreme, and who could not comprehend such merrymaking in any of the family.
"Good heaven, what is to become of us? What are we to do?"
would they often exclaim in the bitterness of woe.
"How can you be smiling so, Lizzie?"
Their affectionate mother shared all their grief. She remembered what she had herself endured on a similar occasion 25 years ago.
"I am sure," said she, "I cried for 2 days together when Colonel Miller's regiment went away. I thought I should have broken my heart." "I am sure I shall break mine," said Lydia. "If one could but go to Brighton," observed Mrs. Bennet. "Oh, yes, if one could but go to Brighton. But Papa is so disagreeable. A little sea-bathing would set me up forever. And my Aunt Phillips is sure it would do me a great deal of good," added Kitty.
Such were the kinds of lamentations resounding perpetually through Longbourn House. Elizabeth tried to be diverted by them, but all sense of pleasure was lost in shame. She felt anew the justice of Mr. Darcy's objections, and never had she been so happy to open the scabs of her 7 cuts. But the gloom of Lydia's prospect was shortly cleared away, for she received an invitation from Mrs. Forster, the wife of the colonel of the regiment, to accompany her to Brighton. This invaluable friend was a very young woman and very lately married. A resemblance in good humour and good spirits had recommended her and Lydia to each other, and out of their 3 months' acquaintance they had been intimate, too. The rapture of Lydia on this occasion, her adoration of Mrs. Foster, the delight of Mrs. Bennet, and the mortification of Kitty are scarcely to be described. Wholly inattentive to her sister's feelings, Lydia flew about the house in restless ecstasy, calling for everyone's congratulations and laughing and talking with more violence than ever, whilst the luckless Kitty spent many an hour aiming her longbow at any deer, rabbit, or bird unfortunate enough to venture too close to the house.
"I cannot see why Mrs. Foster should not ask me as well as Lydia," said she. "Though I am not her particular friend, I have just as much right to be asked as she has."
In vain did Elizabeth attempt to make her reasonable, and Jane to make her resigned. As for Elizabeth herself, this invitation was so far from exciting in her the same feelings as in her mother and Lydia, that she considered it as the death warrant of all possibility of common sense for the latter. And even though Lydia would think her detestable if it were known, Elizabeth could not help secretly advising her father not to let her go. She represented to him all the improprieties of Lydia's general behaviour, the little advantage she could derive from the friendship of such a woman as Mrs. Foster, and the probability of her being yet more imprudent with such a companion at Brighton, where the temptations must be greater than at home. He heard her attentively, and then said, "Lydia will never be easy until she has exposed herself in some public place or other, and we can never expect her to do it with so little expense or inconvenience to her family as under the present circumstances." "If you were aware," said Elizabeth, "of the very great disadvantage to us all which must arise from the public notice of Lydia's unguarded and imprudent manner, nay, which has already arisen from it, I am sure you would judge differently in the affair."
"Already arisen?" repeated Mr. Bennet.
"What, has she frightened away some of your lovers? Poor little Lizzie. But do not be cast down. Such squeamish youths as cannot bear to be connected with a little absurdity are not worth a regret.
Come, let me see the list of pitiful fellows who have been kept aloof by Lydia's folly."
"Indeed you are mistaken. I have no such injuries to resent. It is not of particular, but of general evils, which I am now complaining. Our importance, our respectability in the world must be affected by the wild volatility, the assurance and disdain of all restraint which mark Lydia's character. Excuse me, for I must speak plainly. If you, my dear father, will not take the trouble of checking her exuberant spirits, or reminding her of our blood oath to defend the crown above all things, she will soon be beyond the reach of amendment. Her character will be fixed, and she will, at 16, be the most determined flirt that ever made herself or her family ridiculous, and a disgrace to the honour of our beloved master. In this danger, Kitty also is comprehended. She will follow wherever Lydia leads. Vain, ignorant, idle, and absolutely uncontrolled. Oh, my dear father, can you suppose it possible that they will not be censured and despised wherever they are known, and that their sisters will not be often involved in the disgrace?" Mr. Bennet saw that her whole heart was in the subject, and affectionately taking her hand, said in reply, "Do not make yourself uneasy, my love. Wherever you and Jane are known, you must be respected and valued, and you will not appear to less advantage for having a couple of, or may I say three, very silly sisters. We shall have no peace at Longbourn if Lydia does not go to Brighton." "Let her go, then. Colonel Foster is a sensible man, and will keep her out of any real mischief. And she is luckily too poor to be an object of prey to anybody. At Brighton she will be of less importance even as a common flirt than she has been here. The officers will find women better worth their notice. Let us hope, therefore, that her being there may teach her her own insignificance. At any rate, she cannot grow many degrees worse without authorizing us to have her head." With this answer, Elizabeth was forced to be content, but her own opinion continued the same, and she left him disappointed and sorry. Had Lydia and her mother known the substance of her conference with her father, their indignation would hardly have warranted a moment of their tireless prattling. In Lydia's imagination, a visit to Brighton comprised every possibility of earthly happiness. She saw, with the creative eye of fancy, the streets of that gay bathing place covered with officers. She saw herself the object of attention to tens and to scores of them at present unknown.
She saw herself seated beneath a tent, tenderly flirting with at least 6 officers at once as they pressed her for another demonstration of the deadly arts. Had she known her sister sought to tear her from such prospects and such realities as these, what would have been her sensations? They could have been understood only by her mother, who might have felt nearly the same. Lydia's going to Brighton was all that consoled her for the sorrow of having not one of her 5 daughters married. But they were entirely ignorant of what had passed, and their raptures continued with little intermission to the very day of Lydia's leaving home. On the very last day of the regiment's remaining at Meryton, Mr. Wickham dined, with other of the officers, at Longbourn, and so little was Elizabeth disposed to part from him in good humour that on his making some inquiry as to the manner in which her time had passed at Hunsford, she mentioned Colonel Fitzwilliam's and Mr. Darcy's having both spent 3 weeks at Rosings, and asked him if he was acquainted with the former. He looked surprised, but with a moment's recollection and a returning smile, replied that he had formerly seen him often, and, after observing that he was a very gentlemanlike man, asked her how she had liked him. Her answer was warmly in his favour. With an air of indifference, he soon afterwards added, "How long did you say he was at Rosings?"
"Nearly 3 weeks."
"And you saw him frequently?"
"Yes, almost every day."
"His manners are very different from his cousin's."
"Yes, very different. But I think Mr. Darcy improves upon acquaintance."
"Indeed," cried Mr. Wickham, with a look which did not escape her. "And pray, may I ask—" But checking himself, he added in a gayer tone, "Is it in a dress that he approves? For I dare not hope," he continued in a lower and more serious tone, "that he is improved in essentials."
"Oh, no," said Elizabeth. "In essentials, I believe, he is very much what he ever was."
While she spoke, Wickham looked as if scarcely knowing whether to rejoice over her words or to distrust their meaning. There was a something in her countenance which made him listen with an apprehensive and anxious attention, while she added, "When I said that he improved on acquaintance, I did not mean that his mind or his manners were in a state of improvement, but that from knowing him better, his disposition was better understood, particularly in regard to his treatment of stable boys." Wickham's alarm now appeared in a heightened complexion and agitated look. For a few minutes he was silent, till, shaking off his embarrassment, he turned to her again and said in the gentlest of accents, "You, who so well know my feeling towards Mr. Darcy, will readily comprehend how sincerely I must rejoice that he is wise enough to assume even the appearance of what is right. I only fear that the sort of cautiousness to which you, I imagine, have been alluding, is merely adopted on his visits to his aunt, of whose good opinion and judgment he stands much in awe. His fear of her has always operated, I know, when they were together, and a good deal is to be imputed to his wish of forwarding the match with Mr. Berg, which I am certain he has very much at heart." Elizabeth could not repress a smile at this, but she answered only by a slight inclination of the head. She saw that he wanted to engage her on the old subject of his grievances, and she was in no humour to indulge him. The rest of the evening passed with the appearance on his side of usual cheerfulness, but with no further attempt to distinguish Elizabeth, and they parted at last with mutual civility and possibly a mutual desire of never meeting again. When the party broke up, Lydia returned with Mrs. Foster to Meryton, from whence they were to set out early the next morning. The separation between her and her family was rather noisy than pathetic. Kitty was the only one who shed tears, but they were tears of vexation and envy. Mrs. Bennet was diffuse in her good wishes for the felicity of her daughter, and impressive in her injunctions that she should not miss the opportunity of enjoying herself as much as possible, advice which there was every reason to believe would be well attended to. And in the clamorous happiness of Lydia herself in bidding farewell, the more gentle adieus of her sisters were uttered without being heard. Chapter 42. Had Elizabeth's opinion been all drawn from her own family, she could not have formed a very pleasing opinion of conjugal felicity or domestic comfort.
Her father, captivated by youth and beauty, and that appearance of good humour which youth and beauty generally give, had married a woman whose weak understanding and illiberal mind had very early in their marriage put an end to all real affection for her. Respect, esteem, and confidence had vanished forever, and all his views of domestic happiness were overthrown. But Mr. Bennet was not of a disposition to seek comfort for the disappointment for which his own imprudence had brought on. Instead, he sought to ensure that his daughters would not follow in their mother's silly, idle footsteps. In this regard, he had tried 5 times, and succeeded 2. Other than the gift of Jane and Elizabeth to Mrs. Bennet, he was very little otherwise indebted. This is not the sort of happiness which a man would in general wish to owe to his wife. Elizabeth, however, had never been blind to the impropriety of her father's behaviour as a husband. She had always seen it with pain, but respecting his abilities and grateful for his affectionate treatment of herself, she endeavoured to forget what she could not overlook, and to banish from her thoughts that continual breach of conjugal obligation and decorum. This had been especially arduous during their trips to China, which Mr. Bennet had supervised without the company of his wife, and during which he had taken many a beautiful Oriental to his bedchamber. Master Liu had defended this as acquiescence to local custom, and Elizabeth had more than once felt the sting of wet bamboo on her back for daring to question her father's propriety, but she had never felt so strongly as now the disadvantages that must attend the children of so unsuitable a marriage. When Lydia went away, she promised to write very often and very minutely to her mother and Kitty, but her letters were always long expected and always very short. Those to her mother contained little else than that they were just returned from the library, where such and such officers had attended them, and that she had a new gown or a new parasol, which she would have described more fully, but was obliged to leave off in a violent hurry, as Mrs. Foster called her, and they were going off to the camp. And from her correspondence with her sister, there was still less to be learnt. For her letters to Kitty, though rather longer, were much too full of lines under the words to be made public. After the first fortnight or 3 weeks of her absence, health, good humour, and cheerfulness began to reappear at Longbourn. Everything wore a happier aspect. The families who had fled the infestation came back again, and summer finery and summer engagements arose for the first time in memory. Mrs. Bennet was restored to her usual querulous serenity, and by the middle of June Kitty was so much recovered as to be able to enter Meryton without tears, an event of such happy promise as to make Elizabeth hope that by the following Christmas she might be so tolerably reasonable as to not mention an officer above once a day, unless by some cruel and malicious arrangement at the War Office another regiment should be quartered in Meryton. The time fixed for the beginning of Elizabeth's northern tour was now fast approaching, and a fortnight only was wanting of it, when a letter arrived from Mrs. Gardiner, which at once delayed its commencement and curtailed its extent. Due to the recent troubles in Birmingham, and the army's want of more flints and powder, Mr. Gardiner would be prevented from setting out till a fortnight later in July, and must be in London again within a month, and as that left too short a period for them to go so far and see so much as they had proposed, or at least to see it with the leisure and comfort they had built on, they were obliged to give up the lakes, and substitute a more contracted tour, and according to the present plan, were to go no farther northwards than Derbyshire. In that country there was enough to be seen to occupy the chief of their 3 weeks, and to Mrs. Gardiner it had a particularly strong attraction. The town where she had formerly passed some years of her life, and where they were now to spend a few days, was probably as great an object of her curiosity as all the celebrated beauties of Matlock, Chatsworth, Dovedale, or the Peak. Elizabeth was excessively disappointed. She had set her heart on seeing the lakes, and still thought there might have been time enough. But she was glad for the chance of being anywhere other than Hertfordshire, and all was soon right again. Desperate to pass the time, Elizabeth set off to see the burning grounds of Oakham Mount one morning. It had been nearly 2 years since she had last visited, and it was only a few miles' walk to the top of the mount, which was little more than a hill, with an ever-present column of smoke rising from its top.
Such columns could be seen from one end of England to the other, no matter the season or weather. There was always burning to be done. Elizabeth reached the grounds shortly after breakfast, and was somewhat surprised to see it so busy. Several wagons had already lined up outside the paymaster's shack, each of them carrying large, box-shaped iron cages on their backs. Each cage held anywhere from 1 to 4 zombies. In rare cases, one might see a cage with 5 or even 6. Most of them belonged to farmers who trapped unmentionables as a means of earning extra money, but a few belonged to professional zombie hunters called reclaimers who travelled the countryside setting cages. Elizabeth knew that some of these so-called reclaimers were nothing more than scoundrels who made their living abducting innocents, infecting them with the plague, and selling them to burning grounds. But better to burn a few innocents than let the guilty run free. Not far from the paymaster's shack, the firemaster stood beside his pit, only feet from flames which rose to twice his height. His bare chest was covered in exercise moisture, for he never stopped working, whether coating logs with tar, raking embers, or throwing bales of hay into the fire. After haggling with the paymaster and getting their pieces of silver, the men pulled their wagons to the hookmaster's station, where the cages were hoisted off with a large mechanical device and swung over the flames. Elizabeth could not help but feel a sense of joy as she watched cage after cage of zombies burn, heard their terrible shrieks as the fire, which they feared above all else, licked at their feet, then ignited the whole of their putrid flesh and hastened them back to hell. When the zombies were nothing more than bone and ash, the cages were lowered back onto their wagons and carried away to be filled anew. Apart from these sorts of excursions, the next 4 weeks passed slowly, but they did pass, and Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner, with their 4 children, did at length appear at Longbourn. The children, 2 girls of 6 and 8 years old, and 2 younger boys, were to be left under the particular care of their cousin Jane, who was the general favourite, and whose steady sense and sweetness of temper exactly adapted her for attending to them in every way, teaching them, playing with them, and loving them. The Gardiners stayed only one night at Longbourn, and set off the next morning with Elizabeth in pursuit of novelty and amusement. One enjoyment was certain— that of suitableness of companions, a suitableness which comprehended health and temper to bear inconveniences, cheerfulness to enhance every pleasure, and affection and intelligence which might supply it among themselves if there were disappointments abroad. It is not the object of this work to give a description of Derbyshire, nor of any of the remarkable places through which their route thither lay. Oxford, Blenheim, Warwick, Kenilworth, etc. are sufficiently known. Nor is it the object to describe the handful of zombie encounters which necessitated Elizabeth's intervention, for not one was sufficient to yield even a drop of sweat from her brow. A small part of Derbyshire is all the present concern. To the little town of Lambton, the scene of Mrs. Gardiner's former residence, and where she had lately learned some acquaintance still remained, they bent their steps, after having seen all the principal wonders of the country, and within 5 miles of Lambton, Elizabeth found from her aunt that Pemberley was situated. It was not in their direct road, nor more than a mile or two out of it. In talking over their route the evening before, Mrs. Gardiner expressed an inclination to see the place again. Mr. Gardiner declared his willingness, and Elizabeth was applied to for her approbation. "My love, should not you like to see a place of which you have heard so much?" said her aunt. "A place, too, with which so many of your acquaintances are connected. Wickham passed all his youth there, you know." Elizabeth was distressed. She felt that she had no business at Pemberley, and was obliged to assume a disinclination for seeing it. She must own that she was tired of seeing great houses. After going over so many, she really had no pleasure in fine carpets or satin curtains. Mrs. Gardiner abused her stupidity. "If it were merely a fine house richly furnished," said she, "I should not care about it myself. But the grounds are delightful. They have some of the finest woods in the country." Elizabeth said no more, but her mind could not acquiesce. The possibility of meeting Mr. Darcy while viewing the place instantly occurred. It would be dreadful.
Accordingly, when she retired at night, she asked the chambermaid whether Pemberley were not a very fine place, what was the name of its proprietor, and, with no little alarm, whether the family were down for the summer? A most welcome negative followed the last question. Mr. Darcy was reported to be in town for a meeting of the League of Gentlemen for the Encouragement of Continued Hostilities Against Our Most Unwelcome Enemy. Her alarms now being removed, she was at leisure to feel a great deal of curiosity to see the house herself, and when the subject was revived the next morning, and she was again applied to, could readily answer, and with a proper air of indifference, that she had not really any dislike to the scheme. To Pemberley, therefore, they were to go. Chapter 43 Elizabeth, as they drove along, watched for the first appearance of Pemberley Woods with some perturbation, and when at length they turned in at the lodge, her spirits were in a high flutter. The park was very large and contained great variety of ground. They entered it in one of its lowest points and drove for some time through a beautiful wood stretching over a wide extent, taking care to listen closely for moans or the snapping of twigs, for there was rumoured to be a large herd of freshly degraved dreadfuls about. Elizabeth's mind was too full to be of much use in this regard, but she saw and admired every remarkable spot and point of view. They gradually ascended for half a mile, and then found themselves at the top of a considerable eminence, where the wood ceased and the eye was instantly caught by Pemberley House, situated on the opposite side of a valley, into which the road with some abruptness wound. It was a large, handsome stone building, made to resemble the grandest palaces of Kyoto, and backed by a ridge of high woody hills, and in front a stream of some natural importance was swelled into a natural defence against frontal assault, but without any artificial appearance. Its banks were neither formal nor falsely adorned. Elizabeth was delighted. She had never seen a place for which nature had done more, or where the natural beauty of the Orient had been so little counteracted by English taste. They were all of them warm in their admiration, and at that moment she felt that to be mistress of Pemberley might be something. They descended the hill, crossed between the stone dragons on either side of the bridge, and drove to the solid jade door. And, while examining the nearer aspect of the house, all her apprehension of meeting its owner returned. She dreaded lest the chambermaid had been mistaken. On applying to see the place, they were admitted into the hall, and Elizabeth, as they waited for the housekeeper, had leisure to wonder at her being where she was. The housekeeper came, a respectable-looking Englishwoman, dressed in a kimono and shuffling about on bound feet. They followed her into the dining-parlour. It was a large, well-proportioned room, handsomely fitted up with art and furniture from Darcy's beloved Japan. Elizabeth, after surveying it, went to a window to enjoy its prospect. The hill, crowned with wood which they had descended, receiving increased abruptness from the distance, was a beautiful object. Every disposition of the ground was good, and she looked on the whole scene, the river, the trees scattered on its banks, and the winding of the valley, as far as she could trace it, with delight. As they passed into other rooms, these objects were taking different positions, but from every window there were beauties to be seen. The rooms were lofty and handsome, and their furniture suitable to the proprietor's taste for the East. But Elizabeth saw, with admiration of his taste, that it was neither gaudy nor uselessly fine, with less of splendour and more real elegance than the furniture of Rosings. "And of this place," thought she, "I might have been mistress. With these rooms I might now have been familiarly acquainted. Instead of viewing them as a stranger, I might have rejoiced in them as my own, and welcomed to them as visitors my uncle and aunt. But no." Recollecting herself, "that could never be. My uncle and aunt would have been lost to me. I should not have been allowed to invite them." This was a lucky recollection. It saved her from something very like regret.
She longed to inquire of the housekeeper whether her master was really absent, but had not the courage for it. At length, however, the question was asked by her uncle, and she turned away with alarm while Mrs. Reynolds replied that he was, adding, "But we expect him tomorrow with a large party of friends." How rejoiced was Elizabeth that their own journey had not by any circumstance been delayed a day. Her aunt now called her to look at a picture. She approached and saw the likeness of Mr. Wickham, a crutch under each arm, amongst several other miniatures over the mantelpiece. Her aunt asked her, smilingly, how she liked it. The housekeeper came forward and told them it was a picture of a young gentleman, the son of her late master's musket polisher, who had been brought up by him at his own expense. "He has now gone into the army," she added, "but I am afraid he has turned out very wild." Mrs. Gardiner looked at her niece with a smile, but Elizabeth could not return it. "And that," said Mrs. Reynolds, pointing to another of the miniatures, "is my master, and very like him. It was drawn at the same time as the other, about 8 years ago." "I have heard much of your master's fine person," said Mrs. Gardiner, looking at the picture. "It is a handsome face. But, Lizzie, you can tell us whether it is like or not." Mrs. Reynolds' respect for Elizabeth seemed to increase on this intimation of her knowing her master. "Does that young lady know Mr. Darcy?" Elizabeth coloured and said, "A little." "And do you not think him a very handsome gentleman, ma'am?" "Yes, very handsome. I am sure I know none so handsome. But in the gallery upstairs you will see a finer, larger picture of him than this. This room was my late master's favourite room, and these miniatures are just as they used to be then. He was very fond of them." This accounted to Elizabeth for Mr. Wickham's being among them. Mrs. Reynolds then directed their attention to one of Miss Darcy, drawn when she was only 8 years old. "And is Miss Darcy as handsome as her brother?" said Mrs. Gardiner. "Oh, yes, the handsomest young lady that ever was seen, and so accomplished. She beheaded her first unmentionable not 1 month after her 11th birthday. I grant you, Mr. Darcy had chained the vile creature to a tree, but it was an impressive kill none the less. In the next room is a new katana just come for her, a present from my master. She comes here tomorrow with him." Mr. Gardiner, whose manners were very easy and pleasant, encouraged her communicativeness by his questions and remarks. Mrs. Reynolds, either by pride or attachment, had evidently great pleasure in talking of her master and his sister. "Is your master much at Pemberley in the course of the year?"
"Not so much as I could wish, sir, but I dare say he may spend half his time here, and Miss Darcy is always down for the summer months."
"Except," thought Elizabeth, "when she goes to Ramsgate."
"If your master would marry, you might see more of him."
"Yes, sir, but I do not know when that will be. I do not know who is good enough for him."
Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner smiled. Elizabeth could not help saying,
"It is very much to his credit, I am sure, that you should think so." "I say no more than the truth, and everybody will say that knows him," replied the other.
Elizabeth thought this was going pretty far, and she listened with increasing astonishment as the housekeeper added,
"I have never known a cross word from him in my life, and I have known him ever since he was 4 years old. In that time I have seen him savagely beat but one servant, and a most deserved beating it was. I dare say he is the gentlest man in all of Britain."
This was praise of all others most extraordinary, most opposite to her ideas. That he was not a good-tempered man had been her firmest opinion. Her keenest attention was awakened. She longed to hear more, and was grateful to her uncle for saying, "There are very few people of whom so much can be said. You are lucky in having such a master."
"Yes, sir, I know I am. If I were to go through the world, I could not meet with a better. But I have always observed that they who are good-natured when children are good-natured when they grow up. And he was always the sweetest-tempered, most generous-hearted boy in the world."
Elizabeth almost stared at her.
"Can this be Mr. Darcy?" thought she. "His father was an excellent man,"
said Mrs. Gardiner.
"Yes, ma'am, that he was indeed. And his son will be just like him, just as affable to the poor, kind even to the wretched accidents of God, the lame and the deaf alike."
"In what an amiable light does this place him?" thought Elizabeth.
"This fine account of him," whispered her aunt as they walked, "is not quite consistent with his behaviour to our poor friend."
"Perhaps we might be deceived. That is not very likely. Our authority was too good."
On reaching the spacious lobby above, they were shown into a very pretty sitting-room, lately fitted up with greater elegance and lightness than the apartments below, and were informed that it was but just done to give pleasure to Miss Darcy, who had taken a liking to the room when last at Pemberley. "He is certainly a good brother," said Elizabeth, as she walked towards one of the windows. Mrs. Reynolds anticipated Miss Darcy's delight when she should enter the room. "And this is always the way with him," she added. "Whatever can give his sister any pleasure is sure to be done in a moment. There is nothing he would not do for her."
The battle gallery and two or three of the principal bedrooms were all that remained to be shown. In the former were many good zombie heads and suits of samurai armour. But Elizabeth cared little for such trophies, and turned to look at some drawings of Miss Darcy's, in crayons, whose subjects were almost exclusively the nude male form. When all of the house that was open to general inspection had been seen, they returned downstairs, and taking leave of the housekeeper, were consigned over to the gardener, who met them at the hall door. As the gardener led them along the river, stopping to point out the occasional koi pond or stone garden, Elizabeth turned back to appreciate the house from a greater distance, and was met with such a shock as to make her reach for the sword that she had neglected to bring, for behind them was a fast-approaching herd of unmentionables no fewer than 25 in number. Elizabeth, her composure regained, alerted her party to this unhappy development, and ordered them to run and hide, which they did with no shortage of alacrity. With the herd nearly upon her, she prepared for battle, ripping a branch from a nearby tree and placing her feet in the first position for the wind-swept peasant method. Pole-fighting had never been her strongest discipline, but as she was otherwise unarmed, it seemed the most practical approach given the large number of opponents. The zombies let forth a most unpleasant roar as they came within biting distance, and Elizabeth returned it in kind as she began her counter-attack. But no sooner had she struck down the first 5 or 6 than the cracking of gunpowder scattered the score that remained. Elizabeth held a defensive pose as the zombies limped hurriedly for the safety of the woods, and then, upon being assured of their retreat, turned her gaze in the direction of the musket fire. On this she was again met with shock, though of a decidedly different nature. For upon a steed, holding a still-smoking Brown Bess, was none other than the owner of the grounds on which she stood. The smoke from Darcy's musket hung in the air around him, wafting heavenward through his thick mane of chestnut hair. His steed let forth a mighty neigh and reared upon its hind legs, high enough to throw a lesser horseman clear. But Darcy's free hand held true, and he coaxed the spooked beast back to earth. It was impossible to avoid his sight. Their eyes instantly met, and the cheeks of both were overspread with the deepest blush. He absolutely started, and for a moment seemed immovable from surprise. But shortly recovering himself, advanced towards her, dismounted, and spoke to Elizabeth, if not in terms of perfect composure, at least of perfect civility, as the rest of her party came out of hiding and joined them. Amazed at the alteration of his manner since they last parted, every sentence that he uttered was increasing her embarrassment, and every idea of the impropriety of her being found there recurring to her mind, the few minutes in which they continued were some of the most uncomfortable in her life. Nor did he seem much more at ease. When he spoke, his accent had none of its usual sedateness, and he repeated his inquiries as to the well-being of her aunt and uncle so often and in so hurried a way as plainly spoke the distraction of his thoughts. At length every idea seemed to fail him, and after standing a few moments without saying a word, he suddenly handed Elizabeth his Brown Bess, mounted his steed, and took leave. The others then joined her and expressed admiration of his figure,
But Elizabeth heard not a word, and wholly engrossed by her own feelings, followed them in silence. She was overpowered by shame and vexation. Her coming there was the most unfortunate, the most ill-judged thing in the world. How strange it must appear to him! In what a disgraceful light might it not strike so vain a man! It might seem as if she had purposely thrown herself in his way again. Oh, why did she come? Or why did he thus come a day before he was expected? Had they been only 10 minutes sooner, they should have been beyond the reach of his discrimination, for it was plain that he was that moment arrived. She blushed again and again over the perverseness of the meeting,